Not all meals are created equal. For instance, breakfast has the spicy egg McMuffin for a limited time, and lunch doesn't. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Barry Strauss. His new book is The War That Made the Roman Empire, Antony, Cleopatra, and Octavian at Actium. We have the three players. Octavian, who is adopted by Julius Caesar before his death and is the heir apparent, except Antony, who is Caesar's right-hand man, lieutenant, ambition, and in the triumvirate with Lepidus and Octavian and Antony. Antony has the richest portion of the empire. The treasuries pour in, not only all of the treasuries of what is now Syria, what is now Israel, what is now Iraq, Iran, Turkey, all of that pouring in, Armenia, pouring into Antony's possession if he puts in the right rulers. He has to conquer pieces of it. Remember, Caesar was on his way to conquer Parthia upon the time of his death. However, he also has Cleopatra's treasury, and we now enter into a period that is very dynamic because Octavian's plans include the fact that he's got to have better information. Antony's out of his reach. So we introduce another heroine into this who will triumph quite secretly for all these centuries. Her name is Octavia. What do we need to know about her, Barry?
Okay, so Octavia is the older sister of Octavian. They have the same parents, and they always were close, these two kids. She had been married to a Roman politician named Marcellus. He started out as an opponent of Julius Caesar, a dogged opponent of Julius Caesar, and then somehow mysteriously, he switched allegiances to Caesar's side. Perhaps his wife, Octavia, had something to do with it. Anyhow, he died. She was a widow. Around the same time, Antony was widowed. His Roman wife, Fulvia, also died. Never mind his mistress, Cleopatra. And Antony and Octavian almost come to blows in the year 40. But they make a peace treaty. They make an agreement. And to seal the deal, they agree that Octavia should marry Mark Antony. All of Rome is thrilled at this result. And it looks like civil war has been averted. And this glorious marriage celebrated in Rome is going to seal the peace. Octavia goes eastward with Mark Antony, and they live in Athens, which is his capital, as he governs the Eastern Roman Empire. Most of the sources tell us that the two of them had a happy marriage, and she was a devoted housewife, staying at home, baking cookies, and having two daughters for Antony. But one source, Tacitus, the most Machiavellian, again, of ancient writers, tells us that this was a fatal connection. And I want to go with that. I think that she is always loyal to her brother.
Providing very good information about Antony's plans. Cleopatra
exactly.
is in Alexandria.
Yes.
And during this period, or this is 40 BC to about 36 BC,
yeah.
the Roman Senate has not decided. Now, the Roman Senate, sometimes I think of it as a large trading floor like the Wall, like New York, where
yeah.
they're buying and selling people and each other and revenues all the time. And sometimes I think of it as being inspired about the Republic. What is the opinion of the Senate at this time towards Octavian?
I think that the Senate is very mixed towards Octavian. Some of them see him as a brutal kid, not really one of them, not really part of the aristocracy. He moves up in the world by marrying a series of high-born Roman women. He marries one first, and then he divorces her, and then marries the ultimate prize is he marries Livia. She comes from the highest family in Rome. The absolute acme of the Roman nobility. He has a lot of enemies in Italy. He has faced with an uprising because he has to uproot some settled veterans in order to find land for the veterans of the Civil War and the veterans of Philippi. He has to fight a war in central Italy while Antony's off in the east in order to maintain his position.
And then there is Sextus Pompey. Sextus Pompey is the son of Gnaeus Pompey, who was defeated by Caesar, but Sextus Pompey is an ambitious man. He has revenge in mind, but is he a pirate king? Is that how to think of him, Barry?
He is a superb naval commander and strategist. He builds up a kingdom that is based in Sicily, but also controlling Sardinia. And he's able to raid the Italian coasts, he's able to cut off the grain supply to Rome at will. And so Octavian and Antony as well are forced to make a deal with Sextus. And then Octavian thinks better of it and decides that he wants to get rid of Sextus and wants to destroy him.
And now we introduce the secret weapon of Octavian's success. There is no Augustus. There is no divine emperor without Marcus Agrippa. Introduce him, please, for us, Barry.
Marcus Vipsanius Agrippa. He does not come from the Roman nobility. He comes from a lesser family, but certainly a wealthy family. And he is a boyhood friend of Octavian. One of Octavian's great skills is to recognize talent and to reward it, to cultivate it. He's not always successful. Another one of his generals turns traitor on him. But he is totally successful with Agrippa. Agrippa is a brilliant commander, and he is versatile. He's both a great land commander and a naval commander. And Octavian can rely on Agrippa to do the nearly impossible, to build a new navy that can challenge and ultimately defeat Sextus Pompous. And Agrippa does this. He builds a new port outside of Naples in the Bay of Naples. He builds new ships. He equips them to be able to fight, in effect, a land battle at sea. They simply cannot maneuver. They're not as good as seamanship as Sextus Pompey's commanders. But they can come close to the enemy, and they can fire a kind of harpoon, to immobilize the enemy ships and to allow their ships to come close and to send the marines in to board them.
And this period of time between 40 and the Treaty of Brundisium, and the rising of these contestants to fight each other, both right. are demonstrating their prowess as warriors, as conquerors. In the Roman right. in the Roman Republic, you got to show that you're growing the empire for us to give you respect.
Let's begin
with the triumvirate is re-engaged in 27. Lepidus is off in Africa. They don't really worry about him. Octavian's right. got the West, Italy and Spain. Antony claims the East plus Gaul at this point, I think. Gaul as well. Antony's got the biggest fortune. But Antony wants to demonstrate that he's a conqueror. He's not the great general we think of him. I was surprised by this, Barry. And he's disappointed as he marches. Well, he takes on pieces of the Parthian Empire. He first picks off Armenia, but that isn't his big ambition. What is the opinion of the Roman sources of Antony as a general?
You know, it's clear that Antony is not, exactly as you say, he's not a first-rate general in the end. He has this one great victory at Philippi. And also, as you rightly said earlier, that's partly luck. It's partly that the enemy makes some mistakes, and the enemy's best general mistakenly commits suicide. When Antony goes to war against Parthia, he wants to invade is essentially what's now Iraq and part of Iran, and he goes through what is now northwestern Iran. He totally fails. He races ahead against the enemy with his supply train and his siege train following after him, and the enemy cleverly and cunningly goes not after him, but after his siege train and supply train, and they destroy it. So here's Antony. He's reached the enemy capital. He cannot possibly successfully lay siege to it. There's not much he can do. And he's forced, after a show of force, to turn around and make his way back towards the Mediterranean. And on the way back, through icy roads, the beginning of winter, through the mountains, the enemy harasses him and picks off pieces of his army. He rather heroically holds the army together. But by the time he gets back to the Mediterranean, he's got his tail between his legs. And it is credible that he's lost something like 25% of his army, which is huge to have losses of that sort.
So while Antony is demonstrating in part that he's successful, another part of him suggests that there's not absolute confidence that he is the man to rule the empire. Meanwhile, Octavian is thanks to Marcus Agrippa, is entering into the Illyrian War. How did he do, and how did Rome hear that contest?
So after defeating Sextus Pompey off Sicily, with the help of Agrippa, Octavian then goes to Illyria, which is the former Yugoslavia, let's say, defeating enemies of Rome on the coast and then inland. Octavian's actually wounded in these battles, which is a mark of honor as far as Rome is concerned. And he extends the Roman conquest of these areas, also getting very valuable sailors and naval technology on his side. It's not as major a win as conquering Parthia would have been, but it is a win. It also establishes Octavian's flag on the eastern side of the Adriatic Sea, getting uncomfortably close to Antony's domains. In fact, it looks, though we're not 100% sure, it looks as if Octavian manages to conquer the very important naval base of Dyrrhachium, which is in Albania nowadays, which is really muscling in on Antony's territory. So Octavian's star is rising. Antony, he does manage to bounce back and conquer Armenia, and he does manage to rebuild his forces in the east, thanks to the help of Cleopatra and her money bags. And he also has established a series of client kings in the east, which is no mean diplomatic feat. Still, he has not won the great victory that he hoped to have and that he hoped would make him number one in Roman politics.
All right. It is 33 BC, and the triumvirate is due to be reestablished again every 4 years. But they let it expire. And right. Therein lies the presentation of the crisis is coming. Let's set the scene. Antony is now back in Alexandria with Cleopatra. Octavian's in Rome. Octavian has conquered the Illyrian War. He has Marcus Agrippa, but the two are staring at each other. Octavian no longer giving good information because she's not with Antony. Antony's got the treasury, and they're all deciding that the next step has to be on the basis of our propaganda. And what I love about Octavian is that he uses what we call information war.
Absolutely.
He establishes that Antony is a heretic. Isn't that what he calls him? A heretic?
He doesn't use the word heretic, but he wants to present Antony as a traitor to Rome and someone who is really kind of sad. He presents Antony as someone who has been unmanned by the evil Cleopatra. She's made him behave in un-Roman fashions. My favorite detail is that he suggests that Antony is sleeping under mosquito nets. What kind of Roman man would sleep under a mosquito net? And for Roman propaganda, luxury, giving into luxury was the ultimate crime. And Antony, he says, is doing that.
Dionysius is identified with Antony. What did that mean to the Romans?
So Antony, you know, Antony proudly identifies himself with Dionysus. He says that Dionysus is his patron. And we might say, why on earth would anyone want to be known as Dionysus? That's like saying you're in a fraternity in Animal House or something. But Dionysus for the ancients is not just the god of wine. He's the god who conquered Asia. And Alexander associated himself with Dionysus. So Antony is saying, I'm the new Alexander. I'm going to conquer the East. But the Romans say, nothing doing, baby. You're a drunkard. You are the Dionysus who is the god of wine and nothing else. And that's how that's another part of Octavian's propaganda, that Antony is simply a drinker, not to be taken seriously.
It is 33 B.C., 32 B.C., Antony and Cleopatra are in Alexandria with all the money, celebrating parties all the time. They have very good wine, and they're in the palace. Octavian is in Rome, which is a wooden city at this point. It is not what we imagine today. There is a reason for that. But Octavian does not have the treasury. So we turn now to what the professor calls the unforced error of Antony's life when we come back. This is the war that made the Roman Empire, Antony, Cleopatra, and Octavian at Actium. Barry Strauss is the author. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed, or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 million protection package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. And if you know my husband, Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Goodbye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.